and Innovation Foundation. And we have a really, I think, very interesting panel this morning talking about the future of the internet. And just so you don't get your hopes up or feel like you've been falsely advertised to, we're not really going to talk about the future of things like, you know, what's the next YouTube. That's really applications. Richard might talk about what the next YouTube is, but really what we're going to talk about is the actual internet itself, the system that you think like YouTube run on. Where is that going? Is it working well? What do we need to do about it, if anything? And what are the current debates about the whole issue? How are they playing out, and what's the right thing to do? And obviously in the last few weeks, this issue has been front and center in Washington with the issue of net neutrality and how the actual internet and the core network should be designed and structured. So what we're going to do is I'll introduce the four speakers, and then each of them will make probably just 3 to 5 minutes of opening remarks, and then we'll do a structured dialogue where I'll ask a number of questions, and we'll have a discussion among them, and we'll have plenty of time for comments and questions from you all, and we will end precisely at 11:30. So I'm going to start. I'm going to actually go in the order that we're speaking in, which is going to be this order. Let me start introducing with Richard Bennett. Richard is a research fellow at ITIF, and he focuses on broadband networking and internet policy for us. He has a 30-year background in network engineering and standards. He's been vice chair of the IEEE 802.3 task force that devised the original Ethernet hub standards. And I won't go through all the rest of these. Basically, just suffice to say, has a long background and experience in network engineering and in policy issues related to it. Next to Richard is Charles Jackson. Chuck is a PhD in electrical engineering from MIT, where he specialized in operations research, computer science, and communications. He began his career as a computer programmer. And then at the Federal Communications Commission, he was Special Assistant to the Chief of the Common Carrier Bureau and Engineering Assistant to Commissioner Robinson. He was Staff Engineer at the Communications Subcommittee for the U.S. House of Representatives. After leaving government, he's worked as a consultant and a professor. John Paya is Chief Technologist at the Federal Communications Commission. He is also a full professor at Carnegie Mellon University in the Department of Engineering and Public Policy and the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He has a long background in technology as well. He's been a chief technical officer of three high-tech startups, a member of the technical staff at SRI International, AT&T Bell Labs, and Microsoft. His research spans a wide variety of issues around communications networks. And lastly, Dave Farber, who's joining us by teleconference from Pittsburgh. Dave is the Distinguished Career Professor of Computer Science and Public Policy, also at CMU, in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon, and he holds secondary appointments in the Hines School and the Engineering Public Policy Group. He retired in 2003 as the Alfred Fittler Moore Professor of Telecom Systems at University of Pennsylvania. In 2000, he was appointed the chief technologist at the FCC, so John is filling his shoes in a long tradition here. I'm a CMU chief technology advisor. He's also a trustee of Electronic Freedom Foundation, Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's a fellow at ACM and IEEE. So with that, I think, as I said, we'll get started. Richard, do you want to kick us off here and with a few remarks, and then we'll go down the line.
Okay. We want to talk about the future of the internet and how the technology is developing and how, to some extent, the regulatory framework needs to work in order to accommodate the growth. But I can't talk about the future without talking about the past. So just briefly, just so we're all on the same page, the internet was designed in the early 70s when semiconductor technology was much more primitive than it is now. There's approximately 2,000 times as much processing power and memory in this device as in the original host computers that formed the internet. Just to give you an idea of the kind of design compromises that had to be made in order to get the system to function.
Yep, they were shared by 12 users.
And it was a private system. You couldn't use the internet in the 70s unless you were pretty much a graduate student or a 90s when the World Wide Web was invented, which kind of gave normal people a reason to want to be on the internet, and the opening of the system to the mass public, which brought both good and bad things to it. And I think where we stand today, we're on the brink of an even larger transformation in the internet than the one that we experienced in the 90s. And I think the thing that's going to actually drive that, for the most part, is wireless. We have a number of challenges on the internet today, which we don't hear so much about, because so much of the sort of public dialogue about the internet is conducted between cheerleaders. But in the engineering community, we're aware of the fact that we're running out of addresses for the internet protocol that we use in our version 4. Which is sort of like what would happen to the telephone network if all the numbers that could possibly be assigned were assigned. And you can't make internet addresses longer without changing the very structure of the protocol. So there's a new version of internet protocol called version 6. We skipped 5 for some reason, which will accommodate more systems. While we're in the transition, as we approach the transition, there are signs of tension that are going to affect the stability of the network. One of these is the number of routes on the internet. Packets are routed from one end system to another through a mesh of intermediate nodes. The way the internet does that is fairly basic. And the number of those routes that have to be exchanged by routers is growing at a rather alarming rate, and there's a limit to how large that list can be and still allow for high-speed switching. And one of the problems there is that Moore's Law, which has been the salvation in many ways of the internet for the last 30 years, really only applies to mass market semiconductors. It doesn't apply to the kind of specialized components, static RAMs, and associated memories that are used in routes. Traffic is growing at a rate that's fairly consistently grown to 50% a year for about the last 10 years. It may be growing faster. It's sort of hard to tell right now because the major publicly available studies about traffic capture statistics from public exchange points. And there's a rapid growth in private peering, which is an alternate way of interconnecting networks that isn't measured by, for example, the Minnesota Internet traffic studies. People that operate the facilities that do that will tell you that it's growing at a rather astonishing rate. So one of the growth challenges is right now there are about 1.6 billion people who use the internet, but there are about 4.5 billion people who use wireless phones. As those, the 3 billion plus wireless phone users who are not currently on the internet join the internet, that's going to bring, it'll complete the address exhaustion. It's going to bring us a completely different pattern of use. There are an awful lot of CPUs in devices like cars and home entertainment equipment and home electronics that aren't currently connected, but as we all know, those things are getting connected. And there are the ongoing issues around security, spam, denial of service attacks, viruses, which are not resolved. I mean, there's a lot of sort of bailing water that's involved in trying to keep those things under control. I wrote a paper for ITIF called Design for Change, which is sort of a technical history of the internet as well as an attempt to highlight some of these technical issues that you can get from the TIF website if you want more detail on that. So there are several important trends. Machine-to-machine communications, which is called the Internet of Things. Obviously, we know there's a lot of video moving to the internet. There's a need for low latency services, but I think wireless is actually the biggest thing. And I think wireless is going to demand that we kind of think about how the internet, the service model that the internet has, which is kind of the degree of control that the end user has over how packets are delivered through the network, needs to be revisited. So because the diversity of applications on wireless devices using wireless networks demands a more precise degree of control than what we have on the wireline internet today. But the advent of the sort of wireless internet access network, I think, is going to create the opportunity for a whole new generation of applications to be developed. And, we're starting to see those emerge today with applications that run on iPhones and similar devices that have location awareness, that can, that you use your GPS to know where you are and can tune you in to people that are in the location where you are, to places that you might want to visit, to shopping opportunities. I mean, there's just sort of enormous business for location-aware services, provided that proper security is developed, which, you know, it will be. In order to accommodate the wireless uses, of course, there's a spectrum problem, especially severe in the United States because the government hasn't released as much spectrum for wireless phones as they have in Western Europe, for example. There are some emerging wireless technologies that make that perhaps less of an issue, like beamforming, but that's still pretty much a paper tiger. We haven't really worked out the details of how to employ beamforming in networks that are structured the way the internet is. Perhaps some bandwidth brokering and bartering. Some of the more exciting wireless applications actually just sort of dispense with the whole keyboard screen method of user interaction and use voice and gestures instead. Near-field communications, some of them employ multiple communications modes at the same time. They're enhancements to social networks, and they integrate all of your preferences, calendars, social graph of the people that you know. And in many cases, the goal of these applications is to create serendipity. What's that? It's like if you go to Facebook and you see things written on your wall that you didn't expect to see, but they're interesting. And so it's having information come to you as opposed to the kind of mode that we have now where you go to Google, type something in to go find the information. And that's just kind of a brief overview of where I think some of the emerging applications are and a little hint of how they might stress the communications infrastructure.
Thank you. There are seats in here also.
All right, well, thanks for the opportunity to let me talk here today. Try to be brief in my introduction. We're here today, the session's been organized by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. And one of my concerns about the current developments in with the internet and internet regulation is that it would be easy to impair the innovation process that has been so fruitful for the last, well, almost four decades now, and that I think a crucial consideration in any regulatory process would be to worry hard about how to keep innovation alive throughout the network. Here's an example I'm taking a cheap shot here, but they deserve it. Here's a comment by an entity called Free Press that filed in the comment round of the FCC's proceeding on national broadband plan. And they assert, you know, you speed up one packet, you slow down another, what's the point? Well, you know, by the same logic, letting an ambulance go past a bunch of commuters is uneconomic because, you know, 100 people get home 10 seconds later, 6 seconds later, and somebody gets to the hospital 10 minutes earlier, you know, 600 seconds of delay for some people, 600 seconds of speed up for something else. Yet, you know, when you think about it, gee, we all sort of like the idea that if we're the person who might lose the lottery and have to ride in the ambulance, we'd like it to go fast and we're willing to step aside when we're not the one who's lost the lottery and needs the ambulance. And we see that sort of thing in various applications. You know, I use Vonage for my phone service, and I would like to subscribe to an internet that gave my voice service priority over bulk downloads of files, things like BitTorrent. There's also an interesting issue in the wireless world. If you have a wireless system that's engineered for voice, it has to have a little extra capacity to deal with situations where sort of everybody at the same time walks into an elevator and the system needs that headroom to keep all the conversations going. But most of the time, it doesn't need that reserve capacity. So if you're willing to accept a priority world, what you can say, I can support all the voice users and then take that leftover headroom when it's not being used and provide a data service that has much worse latency than it would be if you were just running everything at the voice rate. But it's useful for all kinds of applications like web browsing. And if you impose a rule that says all bits have to be treated the same in that wireless network, you can have one of two outcomes. You can either say, well, we'll keep the voice system working and we'll keep that reserve capacity idle, or we'll use that reserve capacity and the service will no longer be useful for voice. But you can't have both. Another observation, just for some context, and again, this is gets back to my worry about innovation. Prior to the FCC's adoption of its Computer 2 rules, there were at least two firms that offered email as a tariff service. Telenet and TimeNet, I think there might have been one other. There were, Telenet was a company that was much like an ISP, and it provided services with FCC tariffs under regulations called X.25. And I know of at least one case where a company that had a service that was basically provided over their own email service had, with dial-in modems, had prepared an FCC 214, an application to be a common carrier. They prepared it at the advice of their lawyers and they had it sitting there. So the FCC said, well, what you're doing is really telecommunications. They can say, oh, sorry, sir, here you are. And clearly the threat of regulation created, in this case, it created uncertainty for an extra cost for somebody who wanted to bring a new application, an email-based application to consumers. And I understand pretty well the history of CI2 because I was involved with it when I was at the FCC and when I was working on the Hill. Sometimes the history doesn't match my memory, but maybe I'm getting old.
Hey, Chuck, I just want to explain what CI2 is.
That's the FCC's Computer Inquiry 2, where in that, when the FCC adopted those rules, they said that the tariff email didn't have to be tariffed anymore, and that Telenet had to say, whoops, sorry, we'll offer it on an unregulated basis. And it drew a line that said that value-added services, people who bought telecommunications packages and resold it as like ISPs or people who provide email services, weren't going to be regulated. And I'm quite confident that many of the people who developed and pushed for those policies were really concerned about the issue of freeing up innovation and making sure that people who provided telecommunication services weren't treated like railroads. And it was very successful. And this is just sort of an observation. It goes to some of the stuff Richard was talking about. And there's an important issue, which is controlling congestion in the internet. How do we keep the internet from collapsing under an overload? It did that a number of times in the 90s. Of course, it was minute compared to today's internet. But nevertheless, it was a real concern. And the way it works now is everybody promises to be a good citizen. And it's sort of like, I don't know, everybody promising to drive on the right side of the road, but no traffic law saying you have to do that. And this works pretty well until people start violating it. And we now have applications out there, BitTorrent, which is a peer-to-peer transfer system, which sort of, I'm not trying to badmouth the BitTorrent guys, delivers a valuable service, but they did put a little feature in there that lets it sort of get more than its fair share of capacity. It doesn't follow the honor code. Similarly, there's a web browser called Firefox. Actually, as it comes out of the box, it violates the rules a little bit, but you can adjust it to violate them a lot. And I tried to find out if I could do this in Microsoft Internet Explorer, and I couldn't find the setting in there, but I'm not going to say that it doesn't violate it too. I just couldn't figure out how to set it up that way. But obviously, if a world in which the honor code starts to break down, it's going to be a world in which the value of the internet becomes degraded. And there's always the threat of that. What happens if somebody puts out something like BitTorrent and it becomes extremely popular and widespread, or some virus has a BitTorrent-like capability? What happens to my Vonage service? That's my real concern here about the public health.
Do you want to spend 1 minute explaining the BitTorrent issue? Because I don't think most people understand.
Okay. BitTorrent is a software package that allows file sharing. So you have a file, you want to make it available to others. You can perhaps download it from somewhere. Your BitTorrent client will also make it available to others who want to download it. It's a very clever system, but one of the things it'll do to speed up the transfer of a file, say you've got a file that's divided into 1,000 small parts, some are here, some are there, there's a catalog, you can find out there, it tells where you are. Well, your computer might start downloading it from 20 different locations, all in parallel. And under the honor system of internet, you're supposed to only download sort of one path at a time, not 20, so that when congestion occurs, you back off the same as everybody else. If there are two people trying to download at the same time, they roughly divide the capacity in half. If you're running BitTorrent and you're competing for capacity with somebody who's obeying the honor system, you might get 90% of the capacity and they get 10% of the capacity. Now, at 2 in the morning when nobody's doing anything, something like BitTorrent delivers a lot of value and doesn't create harmful effects for others. But you have to wonder what it does. And this gets me to the issue about incentives for innovation, which is what I began with, namely Innovation Foundation. And that's a concern about what are the incentives to innovate going to be under future regulatory environments. And I think we should think very hard about this. If, for example, if you had a very strong network neutrality requirement, like the one that I showed in that first slide about that's suggested by people like Free Press, that every bit should be treated the same, that there's no benefit to priority, well, then it seems to me that that a whole host of people are going to have a strong incentive to run their applications outside the internet. You couldn't responsibly tell a doctor or a hospital to use something like Vonage, which is a VoIP, a phone service that works over the internet, uses my cable modem. You couldn't responsibly tell a doctor or a hospital to switch their phone service to something like Vonage in a world where there isn't some kind of built-in protection against mechanisms that will create congestion. If you're a manufacturer, are you going to say, well, gee, if I can build a product that works better but isn't really an internet service, am I going to have a bigger market for it because it has features that regulation has denied the internet from providing? And similarly, if you're a network service provider, are you going to be tempted to partition your overall capacity between the public network and a variety of private network or other networks, even like the traditional telephone network, which don't have the same kinds of impairments, that they can provide a guaranteed quality of service, other features that are important. And so that's my concern in the context of some of the regulatory battles that are going on today, is how do we make sure that in the future the incentives for innovation are strong for everybody attached to the network and involved with building the network, the manufacturers, the network service providers, and the user. Thank you. Richard?
Thank you. John?
All right, John Piha, Chief Technologist for the FCC, so I get to begin everything with anything I say today is my own opinion and does not necessarily represent those of the chairman or the commission. Part of the fun of being third is that I'll throw away much of what I would have said and I'll do a lot more reacting. Richard Bennett has done a great job of giving us sort of a long-term big issues discussion. As someone, since moving from academia to government, I miss those sorts of things. And Chuck has raised some short-term, immediate important issues. I think I'll split my time then between those things a little bit. I would first very much agree that the internet is poised for further change for a number of reasons. Richard mentioned, you know, some of them are opportunities. Richard mentions wireless, which I think is going to create significant new opportunities. Also, there will be hybrids between wireless and wireline. There will be new applications coming that lead to change where mobility matters, where new data rates allow new things. We're also seeing new services as it becomes very economical to run big storage or big processing centers somewhere, you know, in the country. And we're seeing interesting new, I will store your stuff for you, I will run your processes for you. It is an exciting time there, and all of that will drive change. We will also see change driven by problems. And Richard points to the address space, which is running out at a frightening rate due to the limitations of IPv4. I would also suggest that a number of security issues are not getting easier, and they're not going away all by themselves, strangely enough, and that is going to drive some change. You know, if I want to launch an attack, I might try and get a botnet. I might try and control lots of computers around the country so I can launch an attack. Think how much fun that's going to be when the computers I can take over are connected to fiber to the home. So these problems aren't getting easier, and we're going to have to make some changes to deal with them. I also think there are some smart people thinking about new ways to change the infrastructure in interesting and exciting ways. So I am looking forward to more innovation. I can't tell you exactly where it would be, or I would have put my life savings there. Actually, the FCC won't let me anyway, so maybe that's okay. To move it more to immediate issues, I should say a little bit about the Open Internet Initiative and maybe some of the issues that Chuck has raised. First of all, as you know, the FCC has a new notice of proposed rulemaking out on it's called the Open Internet, intended to make sure that users can use the applications, access the content, and use the devices of their choice. Also, to promote transparency, so users know what they're getting, preferably even before they pay for it. We hope that this will protect consumers from unpleasant surprises. We hope that this will promote significant competition and create a level playing field. We hope that this will encourage innovation. And I believe, rules well constructed should be able to do all of those things. And that's the high level discussion, and of course that's where the easy part is. Some of the hard part is in the details, Chuck raises a number of issues. Let me first talk about where we are in the process, and then I'm going to comment on more. We know there are hard issues, and I'd look at where this process actually is going to confuse a few people. We have a notice out. It has actual concrete rules that you can look at, but they're proposed rules. It also has an awful lot of questions. And here's the part that may confuse people. We actually want to know the answers. This is an attempt to create a very open, transparent process to deal with some very, you know, complex issues. And the final form is not decided. Some high-level goals are decided, but the final form is not decided. And we are really looking for input and help. In fact, I'm partially glad to be here because if I were back in the office, I would be organizing workshops that you'll see coming up. Particularly, we'll get to play on the technical ones, but others where we will be soliciting serious input, as you might have seen we did in the National Broadband Plan. So this means, if you're going to ask questions about where we will come down on hard issues, I actually can't tell you. I can't prejudge. We are actually looking for useful input to deal with some of the hard issues. And as an example of the hard issues, I'll comment on the BitTorrent Vonage example that Chuck raises. I might, on a factual basis, we could talk about BitTorrent actually opening up 12 or 20 different streams. Long before I came to the FCC, I used network monitoring tools. I actually watched BitTorrent, and you could construct it to do that. Actually, if it's out of the box, it hopefully is a little kinder to the network than that. It doesn't have 20 active, and they're doing their best to try and reduce the impact. But you are right in general. One could construct applications that do everything you said. And
it is more than one.
Hmm?
It is more than one.
It is more than one. I'm 3, if I remember, is the default of 4. But anyway.
Depends on what kind of access network you're on. When you speak.
Okay. I don't remember the specifics. It's been a little while. But the point is the bigger point is what matters here. And I think we recognize we want to build in some flexibility to allow providers to deal with some problems. We recognize we want rules that, on the one hand, maybe we're not so happy if they have the ability to shut down that VoIP stream because it competes with some other services. But we do want them to be able to deal with the legitimate issues of congestion. And we will seriously be looking for input on how to do that. That's going to take some work. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, John. For those of you who came in late, we have a fourth person joining us by teleconference, which is Dave Farmer. I won't introduce again, but Dave is faculty in computer science at Carnegie Mellon. So Dave, do you want to make a few remarks, and then we'll open it up for discussion?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I wish I could see you, but the Congress seems to have trouble with video. I'd like to hit 4 issues, if I may. One, let me start saying that, you know, I've been around the internet for about 40 years, maybe a little longer. Advised many of the people who became fathers of the internet. It is reasonable to say that we were very bad at predicting what would happen with the internet and the early versions of it. Following John's comment, if we had been better, all of us would have been richer than Bill Gates. But in fact, none of us managed to do that. It's very hard to target evolving technology, as people in the digital equipment company found out to their regret, and IBM. There's no reason to believe that the next 20 years won't be even more complex and startling than the last 40. We have a bunch of technologies that are happening. These technologies will start deploying themselves. For example, after many years, people are now producing optical interconnects off of chips. Eventually, probably not that many years from now, they'll be using optical paths on the processor chip to make it easier to design these endless multi-core devices that will help us avoid Moore's law limits and reduce power consumption. These will have a fundamental impact on the network. It's not going to be instantaneous, but it will probably lead to a revamp of the way we do networking, stopping the endless conversion from electronics to optical that we currently do. What impact will that have on the internet? Probably everything. Professor Kleinrock and I, about 10 years ago, wrote a paper pointing out that will probably mean that our current notions of how to control the internet will change dramatically. They just don't work in that type of environment. The other place we're seeing a very, very dramatic change, although historically it's not that dramatic, but computer science and communications sort of rediscovers things at roughly a 5-year interval. But the cloud computing is going to be, one way or the other, a very important future way of deploying computing services. It's not going to replace the PC, but it will augment the PCs and the Macs. That has real impacts on the type of load that the network receives and the requirements for priority, for latency, for all those problems. Much of that traffic will want to go over the wireless world. Both the unlicensed wireless, but more likely the LTR, the future wireless systems. It's beginning to happen in other parts of the world. In a funny way, the United States is rather behind in many ways in the wireless space. Obviously, television, innovative applications, probably eventually virtual reality, not just in games, but the way we attend meetings, the way we meet each other, the way we interact with each other. Reminds me of a book I read many years ago called Snow Crash. If you haven't read it, it's well worth reading. This dramatic change in the way things are done has been fairly successfully attacked over the years by an organization called the Internet Engineering Task Force, a worldwide cooperative group of people who get together not to set standards, since legally it's hard to talk about standards there, but effective ways of doing things. And its underpinning is demonstrated before we say it's good. So it's quite different than most standards organizations, where it's follow our instructions and then see if it's any good. That's been very successful, probably more successful than any standards-making organization in history. We don't want to preempt that in any way, and yet realize that United States rules and regulations, which might change the rules on using the Internet, are going to be very complex in an international arena. I've written several papers on that, talked endlessly on that. I'm not going to repeat themselves. It's a complicated world, again. It's complicated even for those who have been around the Internet for 40-some-odd years. I think I got my first account in 68, so it's 40 years ago. The problem when I was chief technologist at the FCC, and it hasn't gotten any better, is that technical talent within government is in short supply. The FCC, when I was there, had a handful, maybe two handfuls, of people who understood the Internet at a fundamental level. And yet many of the decisions that have to be made, even when you gather the facts from outside, you'll get yes and no for any point you raise in the technical arena. And you need a crew of people who understand the technology and are operating in the technology to be able to make those judgment calls and recommendations to the commission. That's I try very hard to do that.
That's why we have John, Dave.
One person can't do it.
That's why he's saying that there's a deficiency.
That's right. And John is excellent. So, by the way, there was a long period of time when we didn't have a chief technologist, effectively. That should never happen. One of the things I recommended a long time ago, and you know, it's hard to get anything to happen in Washington, is that there be a requirement for a technically aware person on the staff of each commissioner. So he had that commissioner has the mouth towards their ear of where the technical reality is. Again, when I was there, even on the Hill, and certainly in the FCC, there was a lack of an effective path for doing that, other than how much talking I could do, and a couple others, Dale and Doug Sicker, but that's a small set of people. We need a lot more in Washington as a whole. I would speak a little bit of the wireless space. There are a lot of problems in wireless. Bandwidth is one of them. See, when so-called cognitive radio, smart radios that sort of try to hide their information, not from law enforcement, but hide it from licensed carriers, when that can effectively be used. Right now, it's a toss. There are some ideas, but they run into problems. That will help, but there's nothing like bandwidth to solve the problem. There are some people who claim that there is bandwidth out there, especially in unused, unlicensed bandwidth. There's also a lot of bandwidth that's used, that's not used, but licensed. We need a revamp of the spectrum policy, and that's something that has to be led by technical people, not decided on necessarily, but led by technical people, since they're the ones who know what the answers are. I wish the technical answers are. I think, let me finish with one comment. the notice before proposed rulemaking was certainly complete. It was long. It was full of words that worry me if they ever get into the final set of rules, like appropriate and reasonable. It makes it very difficult for technical designers to design new protocols if they have to face at some point in the game a question of what is reasonable. And as many of you know, the FCC in Washington are well-stocked with lawyers who can argue that point until the cows come home, and courts which will argue it until the cows come home. That's a very difficult environment into which to innovate. There are other countries which don't have that problem. I think one of the main things we have to do is to make sure we don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, and the internet has laid a lot of golden eggs. We have to be very careful that we don't kill the United States goose and leave the arena open for others. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dave. I was going to ask a lot more questions, but you went, I think, got answers to some of them. So I'm just only going to ask maybe two or three questions for the panelists, and then I really want to open it up to you all. But let me just start by saying, you know, I think one of the reasons this debate is so heated is because there's one group of folks who are legitimately concerned that there are going to be anti-competitive actions on the network itself, that somehow networks could evolve in a way that could result in anti-competitive behavior or anti-consumer behavior. And that's a legitimate issue to raise. I'm not sure how likely it is to happen, but it's certainly a legitimate issue to raise. We certainly want the ability to have innovation on the edge. There's a whole other group of folks, I think most here would argue that. I'm not going to put you in any category, John, who would say, wait a minute, we also have to worry about innovation in the core. That if we design a set of rules or regulations that restrict innovation in the network itself, we're really going to be in trouble because the overall system has evolved and innovated over the last 40 years, and as Richard and Chuck and others have said, needs to do so in the future. So that's, I think, kind of the high-level issue, and it's one of those where we can't just focus on one piece of it only. We have to be focusing on all of it. So let me start by just asking one question. Basically, the traditional consumer internet service is a best effort service. Does somebody want to just sort of explain that to folks, what that means, how that differs from, say, what a business might get, and what that restrictions, whether that places restrictions on what we can do? Richard, do you want to start with
that? The term best efforts is a term of art in network engineering. And what it means is essentially the transfer of a packet of information is undertaken without any guarantee of a delivery time or a quality of service. So it's kind of a buzzword behind in terms of another buzzword. So it means that when you're on a consumer internet account, all packets are treated the same by the carrier. So even though they may not have the same value to you, the consumer, they're all handled the same in the same indiscriminate manner by the internet service provider. And in fact, it seems to be a goal of rule number 5 in the proposed notice of proposed rulemaking that method, which is sort of an accidental feature of the way current internet service access accounts work for residential users, that should be enshrined in law. Commercial internet accounts don't have that limitation. They're service level agreements that are negotiated between businesses and large institutions that contract for internet service that allow for differential treatment of different kinds of packets, and those kinds of systems are routinely used, say, within a corporation that has multiple campuses. If they want to do voice over IP, then they have a mechanism whereby they can mark their voice over IP packets, increase the priority of them, and make sure that they have better quality than, say, web surfing does, or file backups, other activities that don't have the same time requirements. Because with a voice over IP packet, if it doesn't get delivered within 200 milliseconds, then the quality of the call is degraded. So one of the things that would, in fact, enhance the utility and increase the competitive landscape would be if residential internet accounts had access to the same degrees of freedom and service level discrimination that commercial accounts have. So if we want to have services that over-the-top internet services or voice and video that compete with, say, the carrier-provided triple play components for cable TV-like service and telephony, those over-the-top internet services need to have access to the same kind of quality of service that carrier-provided services enjoy today. And there's a loophole for those called managed services where that they can continue to operate. So I think this is an example of how a rule can be written with the best of intentions that has the, an effect which is in fact 180 degrees opposite from what the intention is. And this is the sort of thing that happens when people rush into rulemaking without really understanding the technical underpinnings of what they're trying to regulate and say all packets are equal. Well, they're not in reality. I mean, they don't have not all of the packets that I transmit on my home internet connection have the same requirements in terms of time to me.
Anyone want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are a variety of services out there that consumers care about that do require this kind of priority, and we see how the carriers have tried to meet those needs. If you look at cable television, I mean, it's possible to imagine a world in which your digital cable TV was all delivered by TCP/IP, but instead, the way cable systems are built is you have one kind of message going in the same cable right next to some capacity that's devoted to internet access. But the protocols are a little bit different. And so the FCC can't say, well, you're not treating all packets the same, because the TV isn't going on the packets. And if you'd integrated the two, you could get a little bit of engineering efficiency out of it. Similarly, in the ATM world, I'm sorry, in the DSL world, the telephone industry world, the standards were built for DSL so that if you wanted to provide integrated access over a DSL connection, you'd use an underlying technology called ATM that does have these quality of service techniques, and you could build a terminal that used the DSL connection and it gave voice priority over the internet access. And that was a technical capability that's there. I'm not aware that it's used, but it seems to me that what happens if you have incentives, if you have a world in which there's either a rule that says all bits have to be treated equally, or almost as bad, a world in which you don't quite know whether that's going to be the case, but there's some probability it is, and you have that, you're facing that uncertainty, you know, because you're not supposed to do anything that's not reasonable. Well, in a world that's not where you're worried about whether what you're doing is reasonable, if you partition your networks and use separate technologies, it's going to be real hard for the regulators to say that what you're doing is unreasonable, particularly if you're using legacy technologies.
John?
Well, first of all, let me push back on the question. I believe very strongly that we need innovation at the applications. I believe very strongly that we need innovation within the network. I don't see any reason why one can't have a policy that encourages both. And, you know, I hope the FCC should, and the FCC could, create such a policy. So that they're not inherently at odds. On the NPRM, I mean, first of all, again, I have to say, yeah, we've started the process. I cannot comment on what the final rules look like because I don't know what the final rules will look like. But if I look at what is in the NPRM today, the notice of proposed rulemaking, I'll try not to speak up jargon, it does not say everything has to be best effort. That just isn't part of the rule. It does not say that if you're running TV, you know, over a non-packet service, you need to switch to packet service. Rule 5 talks about how you cannot discriminate based on content, application, and service except when it's reasonable network management and except when it's a managed service. So there is plenty of room, I think, to work these rules out so that they grant the flexibility that providers need while preventing the risk of service problems.
Let's see, but David, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I want to comment. just a comment, John. The term reasonable is, as you well know, a dangerous term. And I don't think we have the technology to write rules yet that algorithmically I can determine what rules mean. Sidebar, I'd be almost happier if the FCC would say, look, here's our principles. And what this essentially tells you is if you violate these principles, these broad principles, which is what we had, we're going to come and look at you. It's a very effective technique. The initial question that was asked about anti-competitive behavior, on January 19th, 2007, Mike Katz, Nate Barber, Jerry Paul Haber, and Chris Yeo wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, which basically said, you know, we have a good set of mechanisms called antitrust and Federal Trade Commission rules that can be used in that, and you don't have to build another mountain. At least recognize there's a mountain there already, and you might want to trim some rocks on it. And the devil is always in the detail here, and I've seen that. I'm sure you have seen it in many, many cases. The especially just reiterating again, with a short supply of internal technical talent, which hopefully will be changed. John, push it. It's going to be very hard to translate between technical issues and policy issues. And that's John's job. It was my job. But one person has limited time and energy. And I think we need more people to help.
Let me relate it to this point.
John Payard raised an interesting point there, that the NPRM wants to permit discrimination, wants to permit positive discrimination, so that applications that need better than best effort can get it, applications that need less expensive than best effort can get it too. The problem is that there are indications that the direction in which the NPRM is going is that, well, it says it will permit that. It also bans the very means by which you can provide that particular service. So if we can't look at packet source destination and content, then we can't use DPI, which is currently the only effective technology for classifying.
Richard, explain DPI for people.
Deep packet inspection. If we can't look at packet contents and to figure out what kind of a packet it is, whether it's a voice packet, a video packet, or a web packet, then we don't have a well-accepted mechanism in the internet protocols today that would allow us to classify the packets so that we can then prioritize them correctly. And there's sort of a goal here to ban the sale of services to third parties that would allow, say, their video packets or their voice packets to get better than best effort service, because it's felt that that's an inherently monopolistic practice. But at a technical level, it's something that costs money for network operators to do. They require it for their own triple play services. So selling that kind of an enhanced transport service to a third party, even Google, I think is essential to preserve the competitive landscape.
Go ahead.
A quick observation. You know, John says he doesn't know what the rules are, but maybe trust him. They're going to be good. And the question is, once you introduce, what has already happened to investment incentives? The commission has created uncertainty over what the environment was 2 years ago. That's going to affect design decisions, capital investment decisions, decisions by service, by the people who run services on the edge. So now, we don't know how, it's very hard to measure what those outcomes are. Whenever you increase risk, you increase uncertainty. It raises the required return to an investment and makes investments on the margin that were profitable no longer profitable. So I think it's wrong to think that you have to worry about what the ultimate rules are. You have to look at what the uncertainty has done today to the investment climate.
I don't want to put you on the spot, John. I appreciate you coming, but if you want to respond, feel free. If you don't, feel free as well.
I'll respond. Well, I mean, this has been they've been proceeding for 2 years. If what you're worried about is uncertainty, we could bring a little certainty. And therefore, this process would be good. I'm not saying trust me. actually, what I'm saying is it's an open process. It's a data-driven process. Let's participate in the process. I object to people taking, you know, saying that there is a problem because they can imagine a case where a bad policy would emerge. Well, other people can imagine a case where a good policy would emerge. And I think if we do this process right, we can try and find a good policy here. And so far, I think all the signs are good. I like the fact that we are talking about a data-driven process where the facts matter.
Let me jump into a little bit more detail on one or two things. One is recently a number of folks who would be sort of on the other side, or not the other side, the side of action, acting on net neutrality. There seems to be some who would argue that there really shouldn't be any case for managed services or network management. And there are other folks who now seem to sort of come around and say, wait a minute, network management makes sense. We need to be able to prioritize certain packets, but we want to make that only happen by the consumer. So the consumer would have the choice of, I want to prioritize my gaming packets or I want to prioritize my BitTorrent packets. Do we want to comment on that? Because I think there may be some issues. That sounds like the perfect solution here. You allow this, but you give consumers the freedom, and so there can't be any anti-competitive behavior. Technically, though, it may be a little more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be the ideal situation where it's totally up to the consumer to tell the network operator what priority he wants for the different packets. And I mean, it's a difficult thing to do from the consumer's perspective because the application programs that the consumer runs are going to do that. So when you're running, you know, Skype, it tells the network that it's a voice packet. When you're running BitTorrent, it tells the network that it's a peer-to-peer packet. There are some technical reasons why that's not currently the norm in the internet. It has to do with the fact that in the IPv4 protocol, there are three bits that can be used to signal to the network what kind of packet it is. And those tend to be reused by some of the network transit providers, the companies that actually, say, move packets between AT&T and Verizon, or Verizon and Comcast. The network transit companies like Level 3, Global Crossing, Cogeco, people like that, will sometimes reuse those bits for their own internal purposes because they're carrying kind of residential internet traffic, but they're also carrying traffic that's under strict service level agreements for private networks that happen to share the same set of optical pipes that are in the core of the internet. So we don't really have a well-accepted, I mean, the IETF would have to get on that and say, okay, you know, issue a recommendation for how those bits are to be preserved. So in the absence of that, the only effective way that we can do that sort of on the incoming side is for the network operator to use deep packet inspection to classify the packets according to what the protocol is.
That's not something
that should be too scary, because if you look back at the design of the original application protocols, even on the ARPANET, like FTP, John Postel designed a header for FTP that actually has the ASCII characters FTP in every FTP packet to make it easy to identify the fact that it was an FTP packet. Because in those days, the networks wanted interactive terminal traffic to have a higher priority than FTP. And so, you know, it was done for a reason. You know, it's sound engineering.
Dave and then Chuck.
Yeah, just a comment. Talking about the whole transit network brings up another interesting problem. One can do what they want at the ends. You know, you can put rules, be they wise or unwise. But once it crosses into the transit networks, it's going to be, A, questionable whether the FCC or anybody, for that matter, can really control it. And there is a lot of stuff being done there under private agreements, peering agreements, under ways of trying to optimize the network. And so and networks which are private networks like Google's and Amazon's and Alchemy that sort of bypass the public version of the internet. It's a very complicated space in there, and it may be very, very difficult to do anything there. So you may try to put rules on the end, but as soon as they exit the first mile, with quotes around it, into the core network, you may have real problems.
Okay, Chuck?
Well, just as a thought, I mean, I like markets and I like consumer sovereignty, so I generally like the idea of giving that kind of user control. However, I think there's a lot of research that shows consumers like simplicity. And if you sort of think about how would you implement it, oh, well, let's see, you're going to have 1 gigabyte a month of high priority and 200 gigabytes of low priority. And if you go over your high priority limit, then you're going to pay this much for your low priority limit and then maybe time of day pricing. And all of a sudden, you get something which requires an awful lot of consumer interaction in order to make it work right. And you know, simplicity is a virtue too. And I mean, that's one of the advantages of best effort. And that's one of the reasons best effort has been so successful in things like local area networks and elsewhere. It was simple. You didn't have to worry about all this. And in a lot of situations, it works real well.
All right, let's open it up for questions. You can say who you are first, please.
Blake Nolan with Verizon. Just a practical example of where the challenges come in, and I'm not trying to say I think that there's not some valid points here about the consumer sovereignty. I think there is, but we offer a service called Push to Talk on our wireless network. It is prioritized when you buy. You have to have it prioritized. Otherwise, within the cell, you're going to get problems with people getting that service. It has to be instantaneous, and I can't imagine how you could do that any other way than us saying it's going to be prioritized.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Patrice Lyons. I'm corporate counsel, CNRI. The principal, Bob Kahn, is widely given credit for work on the ARPANET and then the Three Network, which gave rise to the Internet. The Internet, in my experience over the years, going back to the Federal Networking Council, is viewed as a global information system. Over the last decade, there's actually been a system deployed 24/7. And it's called the Digital Object Identifier System. And in that, you're focusing on the management of the bits. The publishing industry calls it the International DOI Foundation, and they have branded the DOI. So instead of focusing on just having bit strings running on the net, you're actually managing the digital information itself. So it obviates the need, and this could be at the point of origination. If you had a router, which is simply software, you could manage that as well. So what we've been experimenting with is managing all the components of the internet using this new system. And it's now being adopted in certain other countries. So my question is, why do you focus on network management when you're really talking about the management of the information itself?
Go ahead, Dave.
Certain trepidation. I've known Bob longer than I've known the internet, actually. But there are multiple levels in this act. Sometimes you have to move the bits, and then basically the information management system is fundamentally a capability-based system. Very good one. Experimental, being adopted. I think it's the right direction to go. But you know, you still got to move the bits, and there's an additional function which quite often deals with copyright and other complicated issues which sit on top of it. But if I, for argument's sake, try to move the bits the wrong way, you might not get the efficiency you hope out of the information management system. I don't think they should be tied together, at least not at this stage of our understanding. Remember, it's still a research problem.
Well, actually, Dave, it's moved beyond research, and we're talking to folks, say, in the transportation industry, where you're using bills of lading, where you actually have to have the mechanics of the network itself involved. So it becomes way beyond just copyright. That's sort of the low-hanging fruit.
Let me just say two observations here quickly. Dave, if I can interject. Chuck Jackson. One, my wife works as an editor at a place called American Psychological Association, and for a conversation within the last 6 months, I said something about DOIs. And she said, oh, DOIs are wonderful. We use them. They're so much better than using URLs as document references in journals. They just solve all the problems. They're great. And I was quite taken aback at how emotional she was about DOI. But, you know, editors are that way. Well, you'll just see what happens if you reverse an I and an E. But the other thing is just talking about Kahn looking too far into the future. I'll just point out that I think if there's a paper by Larry Roberts who describes how when he was working at ARPA, he and Bob Kahn went up to Bell, or to AT&T headquarters, and tried to sell the internet to AT&T, and they said, no, we don't need it.
Yeah.
So Con is often a few years ahead of the rest of us.
Yeah, but it's still an experimental thing, and we don't know the division. I'm not saying it's very, very good. But remember, it has to go through a growth period. It gets adopted, it gets used, and then we see where the good and bad points are. Completely agree with you, but don't try to get the two tied together. I don't think they do, but I'd be happy to have a long discussion with Bob. Maybe change my mind.
Let's, yes, sir.
Hi, Dennis Peterson. I work for Congressman Charlie Dent. And this question is primarily for Mr. Pay. Sorry to keep beating up on you, but you know, one of the biggest concerns that we hear from the anti-net neutrality side is that it's a regulatory fix in search of a problem. So my question is just, you know, why October 2009 for this notice of proposed rulemaking? What, if anything, why are we doing this right now, basically?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is a process that's been going on way for years. Mm-hmm. This is not something that started in October 2009. There's an NOI. There were questions related to it in the National Broadband Plan. There were questions related to it in various proceedings last year. There were three hearings last year. Four? I don't know. It's not new. And is it an issue looking for a problem? Well, we have seen problems. We have seen some cases. And we know that if you have a case where a profit-seeking company can maximize its profit by doing things that you might find not useful for the internet in general, and it is technically possible to do those things, then I think it's probably safe to say that's their job, to maximize profit, that if they are given the green light, you're going to see them. So that's why we need to look at this issue and find a way to identify problems where those two things line up, where the ability to do things that we would find counterproductive and the incentive to do things that we would find counterproductive are aligned.
John, I hate to disagree with you, but I don't usually. But I think the number of cases that I can find are two. That's a small number, and they were rapidly resolved just using the principles, although one of them is still in the courts on jurisdiction. The other thing is, I, and I'm sure you, have had long experience advising companies, and I think it's a little bit too limiting to say that they just worry about maximizing profits. They usually have some set of principles themselves, depending on the company. And a lot of the technology companies, you know, do no evil, which is Google's. I assume that we'll see in the future, but I assume that overrides the tendency to want to maximize their profit.
Go ahead.
Well,
you don't have to.
No, I will. I mean, the case you refer to that's still in the courts, one could argue whether that was something that was quickly and easily resolved or not.
Shall we elucidate the audience and say
yeah.
That two cases, Dave, I assume you're talking about, are Madison River and Comcast?
The Comcast, who ceased to do what they were criticized for doing. I have publicly said that it was a stupid thing to do. I said that the other day in Washington, and I still say it. They backed out fast. The court battle is over whether the FCC had the rights to use rule principles as part of rules. I'm not going to get into that. Madison River was just a stupid set of people who also got shot down fast. But I was more more addressing the fact companies do have principles, and I just, you know, it's probably the best example. There are two of them I know personally. Three, IBM, who has stated principles, Intel, who I've been in contact for 40 years, not as a paid advisor, by the way, and I know that the old management had very solid principles, and Google, do no evil.
John, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I'm avoiding mentioning names, not because I want to keep the audience in the dark, because I really don't want to beat up on any one company, and I want to get things right going forward, not going backward. But I do think that the behavior that people found troublesome went on for quite a long time. And maybe there are that one could define rules and a common understanding of what is and is not acceptable behavior, that it wouldn't go on. And people stumbled into it. A guy looking for barbershop quartet music found it, and it took quite a long time. One other quick point. If as for principles, if something is deemed legal and acceptable and it will increase profits, I don't know how a CEO explains to his or her shareholders that he or she is not going to engage in it. That's hard.
I think Eric Schmidt is sometime going to have to face that issue. Okay. It'll be fun to watch.
Now, it seems to me on these two things you talk about, in one case, Madison River, instead of blocking the OIP, should have just given all their users pre-configured BitTorrent clients that would have taken down the DOIP, because obviously that would have been giving away something good. But the other thing that I've heard, I'll talk about this a little bit, in this particular other one you talked about with Comcast, one of the things that happened is Comcast, about a year and a half, 2 years before this happened, was getting lots of nasty lawyer letters from Vonage claiming that Comcast, which has its own phone service over the cable, was purposely degrading the access that was being given to Vonage users and impairing Vonage's system. And then those letters quit coming. And then about 8 months later, they found out that Vonage was slowing down BitTorrent. And I've heard from third parties, Comcast was slowing down the BitTorrent. And there's no question that technically the way BitTorrent was configured a few years ago, that if you were a BitTorrent user and you were sharing your cable, you were the same, next door to somebody who was using Vonage, your BitTorrent could take down your next door neighbor's Vonage connection, really degrade it. No question about that. And I've heard from third parties, although not from anybody at Comcast, that scenario is really what happened. That Comcast went out to find a fix to the problem that BitTorrent was causing to their Vonage customers, and they rolled it out, and some people might say, well, it would have been nice if they just put a little thing somewhere on their website saying, here's what we're doing, a transparency issue that I think a lot of people would think is quite a reasonable issue instead of just doing it in the background. But I see from what I know about the history, and I'm not positive that what I just recounted is correct, but it's certainly plausible, that by blocking the BitTorrent as they did, Comcast made service for everybody else a little bit better, and they enabled an application, a third-party application, Vonage, that actually competed with one of their other applications.
Yeah, you'll notice that Comcast, prior to the latest mechanisms they put in, endlessly told people about it. So companies do learn. It's not what they did was right or wrong. I wouldn't judge that. It's that they didn't let anybody know.
Dana Marshall, I just wanted to maybe get the ask a different kind of question here. There hasn't been any discussion, maybe that's the answer to my question, about the recent developments involving ICANN, the expansion of web addresses and all that kind of thing, their different relationship with the U.S. government. To what extent, if any, are those developments and trends going to affect what we're talking about?
Should we all run for cover on that?
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. Now, ICANN is, to put it mildly, an evolving organization. They're international. Up until recently, they had arrangements with the U.S. government. They now become a freewheeling organization, trying to find a place in life. I think that's the best description. There's a lot of debate. I run a mailing list called Interesting People, which I suspect some of you, if not most of you, are on. And you can get just hysterical discussions on the pros and cons of some of the later stuff that ICANN's done, especially the internationalization of the net addresses, whether that will partition the net, join it together. We just don't know. And again, ICANN, I hope, is becoming more visible to the world. For a while, it was somewhat hidden what it did. Its impact is always questionable, its real impact, because there's the IETF, which sets the protocols. And until the protocols are set, people like organizations like ICANN can plead left or right, but until you get protocol definitions, it's hard to deal with. Now, the IETF has been dealing with the internationalization for a considerable period of time. And the only question now is the timing right or wrong? Is it good or bad in the long run? I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody does.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Ryan Wallach with Wilkie Carr. Mr. Pihot mentioned that caching services are driving some new applications and services. And I was wondering whether network intelligence might be able to offer similar services as to caching and maybe do so at less cost to application and service providers. And also, if that is the case, is there any concern about a network operator doing so as opposed to going through an Akamai or another caching service?
First of all, I think when I talked about centralized storage, I was thinking of things like cloud computing more so than caching, although unquestionably caching is also an important piece of the puzzle, and interesting things have been happening in that space in the last couple of years. So I'm sorry, and would network, I didn't quite understand whether, would network intelligence?
Well, I didn't know if you could you do it in the network? Could you some sort of network intelligence provide the same sort of functionality as a server farm, as local caching, instead of having to go to these huge server farms, which I would imagine cost quite a bit?
I mean, in a sense, that's what a content distribution network does, right? It means that instead of going back to the centralized source, I have mirrors of it, or at least pieces of it, scattered all over the country, hopefully one close to me, and that decreases network traffic, and it it takes traffic off the backbone. It also allows greater communication between me, or faster communication between me, the end user, and this entity, because it's close to me.
I think part of your question is kind of raises something that nobody's really brought out that probably should be mentioned, is that most of the discussion about network neutrality that's taken place over the last 4 or 5 years has really had a strong emphasis on content and websites. It's like, you can't make my website faster or slower than somebody else's website. And what gets lost in that is that there's more to the internet than websites. You know, when we're talking about things like video streaming and voice over IP, Vonage, and Skype, those are not websites, right? Those are different kinds of services. And so the question is, how do you do the same kind of acceleration for those services that content delivery networks do for content? So you can't cache a phone call, right? Phone call has to be delivered in real time. And the mechanism that does that is what we call an overlay network. So you have, there are services like WebEx that's actually a private network that intersects the internet at multiple points that allows people to have high quality of service for conferencing. It's especially good for, say, distance learning and for lectures and things where there are multiple video streams that actually have to be exchanged in order to make a certain event happen. And that's the way they do it, is with an overlay network, which is something that in the intersection between the overlay network and, say, the commercial, and it's typically the commercial account, so you don't have service level agreements protecting quality. But if you wanted to apply to extend WebEx to the home, then WebEx would have to have a deal with internet service providers in order to sort of preserve the quality of service on the laptop.
See, I think that's actually a really interesting business model we've come up with, which is cached phone calls. Because you have no idea what you're going to say. It's there. It could work, it might not work.
Around election time, we get a lot.
I'm just going to comment. I'm aware of instances where carriers do that, and you know, if there's a web page that's being downloaded a lot, and they have expensive backhaul, they might want to cache, and there's a mechanism whereby a web page can be marked as to whether it's appropriate for the carrier to cache it or not. So carriers can and do that. The thing about the content delivery networks is that the carrier may not care much if there's a particular web page that one customer can get real quickly, you know, and so you need things like Akamai or lots of connections to the Microsoft network or the Amazon network to give those individualized inquiries high quality. But if you have something, you know, like the score of the World Series game that lots of people are downloading, the carriers do have the option of saying, well, I'll cache that for 5 minutes and serve 20 people. And networks do that, and it's my understanding they do that.
Yeah, they do it extensively, in fact.
Okay, I think we've got time. Obviously, I see three people, and we have 6 minutes. So if everybody keeps their questions short, we'll go right here and then over here.
Yes. Jim Partridge, NCTA. I'm following up on content delivery networks. Should they be subject to the fifth principle? And aren't they picking winners and losers and getting data to people faster?
Only if they use the internet.
Aren't there two sets of rules for the last mile and just the last 1.2 miles?
Well, there does seem to be an inconsistency between there's big outrage on the net neutrality movement against the comment that Bill Smith said that that Bell South could offer a service whereby they accelerated, you know, certain packets, the delivery of certain packets to end users on their network. And that's exactly what happens if you buy Akamai service. Of course, everybody loves the Akamai service because it takes traffic off the out
of the core.
I mean, it actually makes the network run a lot more efficiently, and there's a huge movement in that direction as, you know, there's more video on the internet. It's the only practical way to handle it within the protocols that we have right now is to distribute multiple copies on these content delivery networks and then, you know, deliver them over really short paths. But it has the effect of accelerating that content over content that all comes from, you know, the server in some college student's dorm room at Stanford who wants to be the next Google. I mean, it's a fact. It's not a level playing field. So the idea that the internet is today or has ever been or will ever be a level playing field is just a myth. If it's a grace like unicorns, that'd be great if that were true, but, you know, it's never been true and never will be true.
Okay, let's go right here and then
back to you.
Identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Costas Teregas, George Washington University, also Montgomery County, Maryland County Council. You mentioned the honor code that kind of held things together. Just a layman's question, is there still an honor code? I'm kind of swayed by the...
And luckily, it's built into things like the Microsoft operating system.
The tragedy of the commons, nobody has mentioned it yet, is kind of a very compelling argument to give support to the honor code. But at the same time, we've heard about intent for profit and capability for profit, which is another side of the argument. Maybe we need an ethicist, not a technology kind of panel, because I don't see an easy answer. I'm convinced by the tragedy of the commons argument. I'm convinced by an honor code environment, but I'm equally convinced that people want to make money.
Chuck, why don't you take that?
Okay, well, I mean, the honor code works for a variety of reasons. One, basically, all the manufacturers embed it in their equipment or their software in various ways. There's some disputes about, you know, people want to get good scores on how their systems perform, so maybe every now and then they'll push the limit a little bit. But also, you know, if for example, the Microsoft operating system, which is by far the most widely used on the internet, if it didn't have it in there, the internet wouldn't work, and Microsoft would sell a lot fewer computers. So the incentives facing somebody supplying systems that are widely used are quite different than the incentives facing an individual user. And that's one of the reasons the honor system works.
I think there's one last question right here.
Very quickly say that the honor code is part of what I hope will still matter going forward. It doesn't work very well if you can violate it and nobody knows about it. even when people are doing things voluntarily. So in fact, transparency is part of what makes the honor code viable.
Okay, right here.
Greg Piper, Washington Internet Daily. Chuck, I think you mentioned something about the Firefox browser actually violating this honor code. Could you explain what that is and what the setting is that you couldn't find in that email?
I wish I had been able to say just a name of widely used Microsoft browser or something like that. I'm not trying to attack anybody, I'm just trying to talk about what's happening. But there's a setting inside Firefox, which is the number of simultaneous connections that can be established to a single server. And if I recall correctly, there's an RFC out there saying the maximum should be 2. I think the default in Firefox is something like 6 or 8, and I think you can set it to be either 16 or 64. I'm sure it's at least 16, like a factor of 8 over the honor code recommendation. And I wasn't able to find the same setting in the Microsoft software, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. It means maybe I didn't look long enough. And there are similar features in some other software, so it's not the only one.
Okay.
But when you download it, it cheats just a little bit.
Okay, there we could actually have another hour-long conversation of what does that all mean and imply in terms of policy. But
I will say there's ongoing work in IETF to correct that. The fact that the Internet Congestion Control is in TCP is actually the wrong place in the architecture to put it. It should be in IP. And there's an activity within the IETF that regards the current situation as above. And is trying to replace it with a better system. One candidate is something called explicit congestion notification feedback. Just